Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Tomorrow is International Women's Day. You betcha. I suppose a lot of you watched, as I did, that special program on PBS last week. It was called Makers, Women Who Make America, which was kind of a strange title. It was actually a survey of the major events and political campaigns of the women's movement since the 1960s. And I hope the interviews helped young people understand what it was like in the bad old days when women were locked out of participating in society in so many ways. But what I found surprising was an interview near the end of the program with one of the daughters of a prominent feminist writer in the 1970s. This daughter is now married and has a toddler son. She had an interesting job in media, but it required some traveling, and she realized that she missed her very young child too much, so she quit her job to stay home and freelance a bit. And apparently they could, you know, get by on her husband's salary, so okay. But in the interview, she expresses anger that it was so hard to be both a mother to a young child and hold a full-time job, which it is. And I thought that the next thing she was going to say was, our mother's generation didn't finish this social change movement because this country still needs to get paid maternity leave like other industrialized countries, and it needs to require a child care center in every sizable workplace. So my generation is going to get that accomplished. But that's not at all what she said. She said she was so angry with her mother for not preparing her for what it would be like to be a working mother. It was really remarkable. So I guess people don't think in terms of collective solutions to widely experienced problems anymore. They seem to think in terms of individualistic responses, which is sadly ironic because that's the way it was before the women's movement. We each figured that, well, we had just encountered some mean people or lots of bad breaks, and we didn't see the context of the cultural patterns until we started talking to one another in small groups, the consciousness-raising groups across the country. Then the dots got connected, and we saw the patterns. Well, here we are at Women's Day in 2013, and there's a lot to celebrate. But there's still a lot to be achieved in terms of making sure that women have the right to live a life of freedom and dignity in decent conditions, a life without violation. We sure are not there yet when it comes to violence against women in this culture. The newspapers across the country are still full of small articles with titles like Man Kills Wife, Man Kills Wife and Self, Man Kills Girlfriend and Kids, Man Kills His Divorcing Wife, and so on. One in five American women today will be a victim of rape, and one in three American women today will be a target of domestic violence by their partner. One in three. So the drift in our culture is not moving in the right direction, and I read an article in the LA Times last month about two fifth grade boys in Colville, Washington, who, following a plan they made, brought a gun and a knife to school in order to lure a girl they found, quote, annoying, unquote, outside the school so they could kill her. This happened in our country. They were socialized by our culture by age 10 and 11 to feel they had the right to kill a girl they didn't approve of. Well, they see plenty of killing of people on television as entertainment. The Centers for Disease Control did a 7-year study and found that approximately half of the homicides and rapes in the United States were directly related to violence shown as entertainment. I also came across an interesting study that was conducted jointly in 2009 by three universities, two here, Michigan and Iowa, and one in the Netherlands. The study was called Comfortably Numb. It found that exposure to violent media numbs people to the pain and suffering of others. This would certainly help to explain something I've talked about before. There's a national survey that's taken every year by this organization. It's a survey of young people like 18 to 24, and it measures empathy in young adults. And the graph they plot from year to year takes a big dive around the year 2000. Empathy is now way down in this culture, while narcissism rates are way up. Not a good combination. I happened to see a film on TV the other night, by the way, Life is Beautiful. Yes, I know. It was very big when it first came out, but somehow I missed it. So this is an Italian film, and like many European films, the violence took place off camera. And nothing was lost, by the way, in filming the story that way. The plot was wrenching, and it was a great film, but it was such a contrast to Hollywood films and TV here. In addition to the constant ratcheting up of violence on TV and in the movies for several decades now, which we cannot seem to stop, we as a society are also now faced with the problem of so many American boys growing up watching violent pornography. Rape and other sexual violence, as I've mentioned, have not lessened in the rates of the execution of the crime. So there was a related study by Jesse Klein. It was actually about bullying, the bullying society last year, who concluded that the escalating social imperative for boys to conform to oppressive, boys and girls to conform to oppressive male stereotypes was behind this greater callousness, aggression, and violence. And I think that's true. You can see this in a lot of areas. The boys are being socialized by the violent media, and the girls feel they have to go along with these values as the norm. And this showed up in an interview I happened to hear on NPR a few months ago by Terry Gross. She was talking with Lena Dunham, who, of course, is the originator and writer of the award-winning TV show Girls. Terry Gross played a clip from the program in which Lena Dunham's character, Hannah, is having lunch with an old college boyfriend, and she says to him brightly, "I'm dating a new guy now. I let him hit me on the side of my body." The clip ends, and then a very puzzled Terry Gross asks, "Why would she do that?" To which Lena Dunham explains brightly, "So she could learn about herself." Oy. Where is this heading, folks? One more thing before we move to our guests we really need to talk to today. She's an expert on violence prevention. But there was an article last Sunday in the New York Times by her column called Big City, Ginia Belafonte, and she talks about being in college in the 80s and what was, you know, left of women's studies, and they all felt that their mother's generation was so passé because they'd actually thought there was such a thing as patriarchal values structuring the culture, and that there was misogyny in the culture, and nobody talked about that anymore. But this article, since she covers the city beat, was about that cop. And the internet subculture that he was embedded in after he was arrested, it became clear. This police officer inhabited an internet subculture populated by men who think about raping and torturing women, roasting them on spits, boiling them, and eating them. And then later in the article, they cut to this former sex crimes prosecutor in New York, and she says, quote, "There's a huge amount of online activity devoted to cultivating horrific impulses toward women. And we haven't grappled with this as a society." And then she added, "There's an odd confusion in the feminist movement." I think she means the younger people say, "We've accepted the idea that speech is protected when it's speech. But that seems to have extended to the notion that there shouldn't even be social condemnation attached to incredibly horrifying misogynist speech. So, unquote. Okay, let's get some help here. My guest today is Barbara Shaw, who brings to our conversation over 40 years of experience working at community, state, and national levels to mobilize the public, private, and community sectors to address a range of social problems and policy issues, including poverty, affordable housing, community development, violence prevention, and children's mental health. Her work has led to the establishment of many new organizations, resources, policies, and programs that seek to improve the safety, health, and well-being of children, families, and communities. Barbara Shaw currently serves as chair of the Illinois Children's Mental Health Partnership, and she's a board member of the Interfaith Housing Development Corporation. In recent years, she co-founded and served as the director of a state-level agency, the Illinois Violence Prevention Authority, from 1997 until last September. Under her direction, the Illinois Violence Prevention Authority distributed over $160 million to local and statewide efforts to prevent violence in Illinois. She's also worked as a senior advisor to the Centers for Disease Control on the development of a national youth violence prevention strategy. Barbara Shaw, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Charlene. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for all the work you've done in this area. And I'd like to begin by asking you to tell us how you came to work on this issue of violence against women.
Oh, gee, Charlene. I, as a young girl, I had a passion for service, community service, and working with in the inner city of Baltimore during my summers in school and so forth, and had joined VISTA at a young age, and had been reassigned from my home state of Maryland to East St. Louis, Illinois, and stayed in the Midwest and stayed in Illinois, and was working for a community mental health center that was funding an activity that I helped create and sponsor, which was a youth center, outreach to young people who had drug problems, had suicidal thoughts, that type of thing. We had a hotline. We used to go out to concerts and help young people who were, while at concerts, were in trouble with drugs they were imbibing and so forth. So it was a youth-centered program, and I was working with the Community Mental Health Center and doing a number of other things with them as well. I was their rape crisis person, and a number of the practicing psychologists and clinical social workers and so forth who were feminists, we would regularly talk about our issues and concerns about the status of women, and they began to see in and hear from women in their practice who were experiencing violence and domestic violence. And this was in the very late 60s, early 70s, when the phrase domestic violence was barely even understood. So this whole movement actually came from women speaking to each other. You talked about that in your comments a few moments ago, the power of communicating what is happening in real life. And we together decided we needed to figure out what to do about it. And in this town of Alton, Illinois, we worked with our YMCA, which was a bastion of very strong female leadership working against racism and other issues in that community. And they helped us raise $38,000 before we even had a program established. And we went door to door, and we built a shelter and domestic violence program in Madison County, Alton, Illinois. And from that, I moved on into directing a shelter in Springfield, and then helping establish the statewide network of programs and accessing public dollars and passing legislation that created domestic violence orders of protection and so forth. So it's been a wonderful journey. It has taught me an enormous amount, but it started where this whole movement started, women talking to each other about what they were hearing from other women or what they were experiencing as women.
Mm-hmm. You know, I heard a similar story at an international level where I think it was, I forget which institute in Washington, D.C., something that's focused on international issues. And there was a grant, a research project, and these women were going door-to-door in different countries asking questions about the economic situation of families. The whole grant was about economics and whether there were small-scale economic opportunities or not, and da-da-da. But what they found at almost every door they knocked down on was evidence of domestic violence disrupting, you know, life for the women, certainly. So that, you know, became a section of the report they filed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not named and framed until women put it there. So, yeah, that's interesting. That was
exactly
the same
right.
pattern there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so over the years, as you, I'm sure, gave a lot of thought to where is this coming from, what's the feeder system, what's the cultural dynamic, how do you see things like racism, sexism related to violence? I mean, you know, we say, as I pointed out in the introduction, we seem to live in a violent culture.
Well, certainly sexism is the strongest root of the many ism roots that are related to domestic violence and violence in the culture period. But, you know, violence is an expression of a variety of emotions and power and control over a person that you feel you either have the right to or somehow the culture supports you perpetrating that violence. And the patterns that we've seen in domestic violence and sexual assault directed at women, directed at children, are power dynamics. And when you have an historical pattern of racism that reflects power over and an ability to and a willingness and a cultural support to discrimination and aggression towards the other, then violence is the ultimate manifestation of that aggression. And for generation upon generation upon generation, worldwide, we have allowed and continue to allow the culture to, in general, while there may be, there's been a lot of change here in the United States in terms of attitudes and norms about this, but in general, our culture still is one where the sexism enables the constant degradation of women and violence against women in the media, in video games, in pornography, and in homes.
Yeah, and we might add, since the last election cycle, in the halls of Congress, because
yes, I mean,
the amazing
in the military,
thing from the Republican congressmen and Republican candidates mm-hmm. aspiring to become congressmen and senators mm-hmm. said were just mind-boggling. Their actual views about women that they blurted out was just, you know, antediluvial.
Well, you know, we are trying to make progress in this area, and we certainly have made progress. There's no question about that. But there is such a strong underlying scratch a little bit culture that still is just appalling and results in real pain and loss of quality of life for millions of women.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what's your sense of the actual scope of sexual assault? Let's start in our domestic culture.
Oh, gee. Well, in our domestic culture, we have sort of known numbers, you know, reported numbers. One in four women will have been sexually assaulted in her lifetime. We know however, that those numbers are so underreported. The estimates are that between 10 and 20% of sexual assault experienced by people old enough to even report it is reported. So I think it's probably the most pervasive form of violence against girls and women, period. And that it is yet to be understood as pervasive as it is, and it's a movement that, while many people in the sexual assault movement and violence against women movement have been and child welfare movement have been trying so hard to address and uncover and expose, I think we don't know the hundredth of it. When I hear people that I come into contact with talking about their experiences as kids with their grandfather or their uncle or
I
a
was
teacher
just thinking
or whatever,
like
you
that,
know,
yeah.
It is, we barely see children able to come forth and talk about pretty horrific acts of sexual assault, and many times it's years later. Look with the Catholic Church. Look how many of the victims, of priests, people in authority over them, not the stranger.
not only authority, but the inner spiritual life.
Exactly.
I mean, it was horrendous.
And it took some of these folks 20 and 30 years. Before they could even speak about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm convinced that there are huge numbers of children, male and female, certainly, but we're focusing on girls today, who are victims of all sorts and all types of sexual assault by family members, by extended family members, and by people in their world, in their school world, in their church world, in their community world.
Right. And we don't seem to have made progress on stopping the feeder system of the perpetrators. That's what really gripes me. I was hearing an interview, actually this was a couple of years ago, again, Terry Gross on NPR, and I was driving in the car, and she's interviewing a woman who works with a center for pregnant teenagers somewhere. And she said, well, at first they won't say anything about the causes of their background, of what they've been through. But after you get to know them for, many months, they'll open up and say a very high percentage of them were, as this speaker put it, introduced into sexual activity at an earlier age. And so Terry Gross says, and next question. She just goes on. And I'm driving in the car. I practically drive off the road. I'm going, Terry, they were raped as girls. Jump on that. They were raped as girls. Why isn't this named? And, have not enough of the family, friends, the people doing this been sent to jail in these communities? I mean, it seems like there's still this carte blanche, because as you say, it's easy to threaten a child and say, if you ever tell anyone, I'll kill you, which is what they apparently often say.
Well, I do want to say we have named it. We have, there are child sexual assault centers all over the country now designed to help children get through a process of naming their perpetrator, and certainly through the Violence Against Women Act, which was recently reauthorized, has for years since it was enacted in 94 has contributed towards an improved law enforcement system response and support for victims and so forth. But the reality is those are only the very tip of the iceberg cases that come to the attention of the system. What grieves me are the myriad of girls who are experiencing this form of violence and never have access to or feel they can even talk to anyone about what it is that they're experiencing. It's such a complex thing in our culture. Sexuality is a difficult thing in our culture, period. And secondly, when it's somebody you know and somebody who has power over you emotionally or physically or whatever, it becomes a very complicated thing to talk about.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the impact of the actual crime further can harm and hurt and result in, you know, substance abuse or whatever, and you end up in blame the victim. You end up with this kid being seen as a problem kid and, on and on.
Right. There's also, it seems, with this nosedive of empathy in our country among young people, well, I'm thinking of this situation someone told me about who used to teach women's studies at, I think, Florida State University. And she was teaching a course on violence against women. And so she laid out, you know, all the statistics and oriented them on about this situation. These were undergraduates. And one girl in the class put her hand up and said, you know, I think now what happened to me was rape. I couldn't figure out what happened. It was, you know, but I was forced to do this and this. And in the old days, in a women's studies class or a women's circle in anybody's living room or around the kitchen table, people would have said, oh, my gosh, that's terrible what you went through. Mm-hmm. But the other girls in the class now, this is like 2011 and 12, got this just disgusted, disapproving look on their face, like, oh, God, what an awkward conversation. Why are you bringing this up? That's so uncool.
Oh, my.
And later, the professor said, very many of them individually came into her office hours and said, you know, this happened to me. Mm-hmm. My boyfriend passed me around among his buddies on the baseball team, and again, this happened to me. But in that setting, it would just be so uncool and vulnerable to show empathy. I mean, that's what I meant earlier, moving on to the male model. You know, the male and the female have different emotional universes, and we can make that work. But when the norm moves on to the male side, you know, empathy is something a lot of psychological tests show men are afraid of because they're afraid it'll drag them down to the level of the person that they might feel bad for. So they stiff-arm the whole thing. Okay, women, very relational, naturally feel other people's pain and empathy. But these girls have that completely blocked out of their behavior in order to be functioning on the male model and win approval to be that way. So that's a new development. Anyway, we have to pause right now for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Barbara Shaw, on All Together Now. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Barbara Shaw. Well, today, the eve of International Women's Day, President Obama signed into law the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. And this happened after the U.S. House of Representatives, like the Senate before them, finally passed this reauthorization. It was the House that was dragging their feet on it, the Republicans in the House, that is. This law offers legal protections for women against sexual violence, harassment, and abuse. And the reauthorized version expands it. It closes some gaps in related funding and safeguards that have manifested since the law was first passed in, I think, 1994. And it also includes housing subsidies now for survivors of domestic violence. Plus, it now offers extended legal protection for Native American women and immigrants, regardless of their legal status, for the first time. It will extend similar guarantees to sexual minorities. Moreover, the new version of the Violence Against Women Act incorporates the Campus Sexual Violence Elimination Act, known as Campus Save. That's capital S, small a, capital V, capital E, Campus Save. That was necessary because young men who rape on campus and who are considered by the male authorities to have their whole careers ahead of them generally get the same kind of institutional protection as men who rape in the military or in the church. A study found that institutional barriers on campuses either assured the victim's silence or it left them feeling victimized all over again. Even students who are found, quote, responsible, unquote, for alleged sexual assaults often face little punishment, while their victim lives are frequently, of course, turned inside out. And then this bill, by the way, was not signed in the White House where they usually signed. It was signed over in the Interior Department. I listened to President Obama's speech, the little talk he gave before signing it, and it's on Huffington Post this morning. And he said, well, we moved it over here because there's so many of you who did so much to get this act reauthorized, working with women's groups in different sectors all over the country and worked to make this finally happen. But it's also in the Interior Department because a section of the law really fixes a big problem for Native American women, and that was that a non-Native man could come onto the reservation land and rape Native women and not be tried by the Native judicial system, which is the only law that prevails on the reservation land. So he couldn't be tried out in the court system around the reservation, and he couldn't be tried inside because he wasn't a Native person. So there were very high rates of rape in many of the areas by non-Native men coming onto the reservation, and this will be changed. They will now be under the jurisdiction to be prosecuted by the Native judiciary system. Still, the first vice president of the National Congress of American Indians, Juana Mihel Dixon, observed after this act was finally passed, quote, 500 plus days is too long to not have a bill for all women in America. For an unimaginable length of time, those who have terrorized our women have gone unprosecuted, unquote. Absolutely right. Well, Barbara Shaw, I'm wondering about your general sense of this Violence Against Women Act in its expanded form. It seems to be addressing very necessary steps after the fact. I know you focus on prevention, which we'll get into. But what do you think of the general drift of the way things are going with this law?
Well, this is magnificent that this law, that this reauthorization passed in the form that it was passed. There was quite a bit of surprise, actually, on the part of a lot of people that it did pass with all of the enhancements and improvements that you mentioned. There was considerable concern about some of them, and the reauthorization had been held up for a very long time for these reasons. So it's great that it passed in the form it did, and some of the loopholes that have been addressed here are so critical. They affect the very life and well-being of women and children, immigrant women, Native women, lesbian women, just a wide variety of people who deserve the full protection of our country. So we're clearly moving in the right direction here. It's quite disturbing, though, to hear that there are people who still resist the kinds of improvements that were outlined and enacted through this reauthorization. But it's proof of what we were talking about earlier, that there's just so much more to do here in terms of changing attitude.
Yeah, I understand that the Republicans in particular didn't want to spend any money on things like the subsidy for battered women, getting them into safe housing. And they didn't like that bit about trying non-Native men in the reservation court system. But, that's what's going to happen.
It is what's going to happen, and it's about time. And I want to add that the provision protecting Native women extends to all forms of domestic violence too. So we're talking about the. In fact, it's put in terms of domestic violence with rape, aggravated assault, and murder being the forms of domestic violence that this will address. So it's very, very important that, that this happened, because the rates of those crimes, as you mentioned, were off the charts compared to the rest of the culture, and it's inexcusable that we're still discriminating against Native women after all these years.
Yeah, and they weren't considered important enough.
They
to
weren't
act
considered
sooner.
Important enough. To...
Well, I'd like to move into violence prevention, especially the fact that you advocate a public health approach to violence prevention. What does that entail?
Well, very simply put, a public health approach, number one, recognizes that the problem that we're addressing is a health problem, and a public health problem at that, that it can affect anybody, any age, race, religion, what have you. And that, secondly, that it is a health problem that can be prevented, and that by learning about and understanding the risk factors associated with that problem, the what we call protective factors, those factors like a strong role model for young boys, for example, that, and girls, that can be a positive protective factor that can mitigate risk and reduce risk. That it, by focusing on those risk and protective factors and working on those things at multiple levels, at a socio-ecological level, not just the individual level, not just the individual's problem, but, you know, we have to address the seatbelt of violence, the gun. We have to address the, in terms of the instrument, you know, the car, we have, the seatbelt is a method of dealing with a tool that is part of the health behavior that's outside the individual. We have to look at it from the individual perspective, the family risk factors, the community risk factors. You know, if you live in a community where drug dealing is happening on every other corner, and there are liquor stores on every other corner as well, and there's a culture of gang violence, the risk to the individual goes up significantly. We have to talk about the societal risk factors, the prevalence of firearms that makes violence so much more lethal in our culture. We have to look at the media violence that you alluded to earlier, and the cultural violence, and the very policies and deeply rooted systemic problems that feed the violence. So public health approach looks at it from all those levels, recognizes that it's preventable, and then uses a scientific approach. What works? What works in reducing risk? What works in advancing protective factors that we can then, once we determine they work, we can replicate throughout the public at large. Those are the sort of elements of a public health approach.
You know, one thing I wonder about with what we were talking about before, when young girls are raped or otherwise sexually abused by a male relative or family friend or someone in the youth organizations that, or the schools or whatever, it's so prevalent at every socioeconomic level. And I've wondered about that feeder system. I've wondered about the men who do that. And I wonder, you know, on the one hand, you could say, well, they're just vicious predators. On the other hand, you could say they're ignorant. They don't get it. They don't understand that for a girl's body and self to be violated in this way is a huge, probably lifetime trauma. You are, in a sense, unless you can really recover well, wrecking a person's life. So it's not true for you to say, oh, well, sex is natural, you know, you do it now or later, it's not a big deal, it's like eating. I mean, that whole narcissistic self-rationalizing behavior going through their head, could this not be addressed by a public education campaign? I mean, I suppose maybe, you know, as people would say, oh, no, we don't want to talk about that out loud. But there was a public education campaign back when mothers and fathers, when they were expecting a child, nobody understood that smoking cigarettes and drinking alcohol was having a direct effect. I mean, in the 50s, a lot of people did that. And so there was a big campaign. Do not drink alcohol or smoke cigarettes during those 9 months. You'll be hurting the fetus, the development of your child. And people got it. So I wonder if there couldn't be another campaign in every socioeconomic level saying, men, we want you to understand that any sexual move on a child is going to cause a trauma in that life. It's not lightweight to them. I mean, what would you think of that?
Charlene, I think you've hit upon something very, very critical. You know, those of us who care about this and who work on these issues, and actually the general public, I think, has a sense that somehow men and are supposed to just know this, and that all of us are supposed to know this, what you just said, know the profound impact of this form of aggression and assault on a child and on a young girl. But we don't. We don't know it. So we assume that it's known. We assume that it will once it comes forth, that it will be treated seriously and treated as a crime, and it isn't. The kind of internal psychological trauma damage that is done has not been fully discussed or talked about. We have not unpacked this problem. We barely can acknowledge that it happens, much less really try to get at why it happens so frequently. And, you know, we're talking about a continuum of types of predators here. We're talking about, you know, the pedophile whose wiring is completely distorted. All the way to the average Joe, you know, who has perhaps had been, quote, introduced to sexual behavior at a young age themselves, and somehow think of that as normal, or as can't resist their own urge to inflict that same pain on others. We see those cycles happen,
right?
All the way to the man who just, as you said, just refuses to get it and doesn't care. On some level, doesn't care to know, could know, doesn't care to know, and just has a sort of depauperated stump of a brain when it comes to that part of realizing.
Yeah, the bottom line on the public education posters has to be, you will go to jail.
Exactly, but I really think that the prevalence, the you know, every perpetrator or every person who inflicts this is not a pedophile. You know, really breaking through the misunderstandings we have about who does this and why they do it.
Yeah. Lots of
more
work
and more
to be done there. Yeah,
mm-hmm, much more. I really like that idea of pursuing it from the aspect of the trauma. And you know, trauma. Our understanding of trauma beyond trauma experienced by people who participated in war, it's a very recent phenomenon. You know, I helped start and am part of a childhood trauma coalition here in Illinois that is working on promoting trauma-informed support for children in every environment, you know, having child care workers know what are the symptoms of trauma so that when the kid is regressing and is wetting his pants or is when he already knew how to do that, knew how to use the toilet, and you have kids acting out who may not have acted out before, that these could be signs of trauma. And we're really understanding the lifetime implications of childhood trauma on the development of the brain. On the development of social interactions, social and emotional behavior. It's a very, very important field now, this trauma and its impact on children. In fact, our coalition has been working with people across the country to try to add a new diagnosis to the DSM, what will be DSM-5. In order that there are trauma symptoms and trauma syndromes that are not PTSD. You know, right now there are classic symptoms that are defined as post-traumatic stress disorder that was established in relation to people who experience trauma in war and in other, you know, highly catastrophic kinds of situations. And what psychologists and psychiatrists and trauma workers are working on here is an understanding that there's a whole nother set of responses. Again, brain development, behavioral, social, emotional development that is related to childhood trauma, and that we need to understand that and not have to box it into PTSD.
Wow, that's a good thing.
The whole new field, trauma.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned a few shows back this study last spring that was in the media showing that children under the ages of 10 who experience trauma, experience violence or witness violence being perpetrated on someone have a deep bodily response to that, and it shortens the telomeres in their DNA structure in their cells, much in the way that scientists see, physiologists see in the aging process. And they figure this shortening of those telomeres is cutting about 7 to 10 years off their lives.
My goodness.
But this is what I call relational physiology. You know, this interpersonal relationships have a direct bearing on our physicality, and this was not at all imagined in the biomechanical model of the person that the medical system grew up to fit.
Exactly right. We've really, you know, bifurcated the human being, you know, into the physical body and everything else, you know.
Yeah.
And we've reaped what we've sown there, and we have a lot of work to do to make that reconnection. And you know, go ahead.
Yeah, but it is. I mean, there is a lot of work, and also I'm happy that the science is finally
you know, catching up,
contributing to. Oh, gee, we had it wrong.
Right.
It's like this. Well, I have to say we've run out of time. There's so much more I would love to learn about here, but we'll have to leave it here. And Barbara Shaw, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Oh, thank you so much, Charlene. It was a really great talking with you.
Okay. Let's move over to the Arts Corner and see what we have this week. And our poem for Women's Day is one by Hannah Block. She's a poet and translator, the author of several award-winning books. Hannah Block has published 4 poetry collections, The Secrets of the Tribe, The Past Keeps Changing, Mrs. Dumpty, and Blood Honey. She received the 2012 Meringoff Poetry Award, 2 fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and several prizes. The poem we'll hear now is about a newlywed couple who go to the theater. The play they happen to see is Ibsen's Hedda Gabler. This poem is entitled Act One. Hedda Gabler is lighting the lamps in a fury. From the front row center, we see the makeup streaking her neck, little tassels of sweat that stain her bodice. She says yes to Tesman, and it's like spitting. We are just married, feeling lucky. Between the acts, we stop to admire ourselves in the lobby mirror. But Hedda, how misery curdles her face. She opens the letters with a knife, and her husband stands there shuffling, the obliging child waiting to be loved. Yes, she says, fluffing the pillows on the sofa. Yes, dear, stoking the fire, and Tesman smiles. A shudder jolts through her body to lodge in mine, and, oh yes, I can feel that blurt of knowledge no bride should know. For our song today, here's a Women's Day anthem, Aretha Franklin and Annie Lennox singing a duet entitled Sisters Are Doing It For Themselves. Are doing it for themselves. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who the guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Join me next week when my guest will be Richard Heinberg, author of Peak Everything and The End of Growth, adapting to our new economic reality. Till then, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.